Jesus asks us to do, that's what we ought to do.
That's right. Whatever he asks you, says to you, do it. And I don't know how, you know, that's just so, so important for us to remember. Now we're moving into, after Mary made that statement, said, oh, whatever he asks you to do, do it. Then we're getting into the performance then of the miracle of turning the water into wine. So if someone would read verses 6 through 11 for us, please, and then we'll go back and look at those.
There was set six water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to him, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Okay. We'll be spending today and next Sunday will be my last time to teach before Bob starts in April. No, in March. So let's go back and start and just think about it. And first I want to ask you, what was the primary purpose of miracles?
Make believers.
It was to make believers. That was one.
Show his power.
So kind of those two things. I think we're going to notice in these six verses about this miracle, we're going to observe the physical things and the spiritual things kind of interacting together and working together and toward the manifestation, the way it calls it, is the manifestation of the glory of the Lord. So Jesus' purpose on earth, and he's beginning right off with his ministry, was to manifest the glory of his Father in heaven. And the reason that he was to manifest that, the glory of God, that's the source of three very critically important tenets of our religion. What are those three important tenets? I mean major. Faith, hope, and charity, or love. It was our faith and hope in him and his love for us. Those three things. I want someone to turn and read 1 Peter, the first chapter, verses 20 and 21. 1 Peter 1, 20 and 21.
He indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you, who through him believed in God, raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God.
Okay. So what is the greatest manifestation of God to us? What is the greatest?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus. It would be Jesus, but even more basic than that, what characteristic of God does that reveal? His love, yeah. And it's all the same. But in 1 John, someone turned to 1 John, the 4th chapter, verse 9. 1 John 4, 9.
This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him.
Okay. So that's where it all ties together. God's great love for us. He sent his Son, Jesus. That was the representation, or that was the form of his love. And so then our part is having faith in that, and that will bring on hope. And of course, then that will instill love within us then for one another and for God too. So we still have those three basic tenets, faith, hope, and charity, or faith, hope, and love. Okay, now I just thought that was interesting to maybe go and take a look at that. But now let's take a look at the verses. In verse 6 it said, Now there were set there six water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. So we start with these six water pots of stone. Let me ask this question. Did these water pots typically have anything to do with the wine being served at the wedding feast? As the pots were sitting there, did they have anything to do with the serving of wine at the wedding feast?
It doesn't sound like it, I guess.
No, I don't.
They weren't typically for wine, were those big pots?
And that's right. So, actually, I think no is the answer probably on that, because these water pots were really available, and it tells us, for the purification rites of the Jews. So, now notice how there were six pots. They would hold from 20 to 30 gallons apiece. So what's that total volume of water or wine? It would be 120 if it's 20. It'd be 180 gallons. I think maybe this kind of indicates the extent of the size of the crowd that was at the wedding feast. Now, okay, let's look at this. According to the manner of the purification of Jews. Before I started studying this, I never had really picked up exactly what that was inserted there for, exactly what that was meaning. But I think that when we think about it, there were six water pots there according to the manner of the purification of the Jews. Where would we look in the Old Testament to find the rules regarding these rites of purification?
I guess Leviticus would be.
No?
Leviticus, Numbers, or Deuteronomy?
No. No. No.
Exodus?
No.
It's not there.
It's not there. It's not there. There's none to be found. It's one of the traditions that were added to the law by the Jewish people, or the rabbis. Someone turn to Matthew. Let's all turn to Matthew, because we're going to look at that just a little bit more. Matthew 15, verses 1 and 2.
Then some Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat."
Okay, so here we see this introduced, this idea of the tradition of the elders. Jesus was asking them, they were asking, why do your disciples transgress the traditions of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. Of course, they had a lot of these traditions, and this was a tradition of purification. And I thought it fits well with what we're talking about. But when we think about the traditions of the elders, in and of themselves, are traditions wrong?
No.
No. Okay. That's what I would say.
They're dangerous.
Can they be wrong? What makes them wrong?
When men depart from the Word of God.
That's right. That's right. When it's against God's will, it is wrong. It's sin. One more. Go ahead.
I would say another way they can be wrong is if we take them as seriously as we take the Word of God.
Okay. And that kind of fits in with the second one I had then. When we take a tradition that maybe is good, but if we try to bind that on others as doctrine, then that's not good. And we'll look at that we're going to look at verse 7 in Matthew to kind of see what happens here. Because, you know, trying to bind opinions or traditions that are not necessarily taught in the Bible, but they're maybe Well, they fit in with what we're trying to do, but trying to bind those on, those are a major cause of strife in the church. And so we need to try to avoid those. But Jesus turned around, and they asked him that question, and he turned right around, and what did he say in verse 3?
What is your tradition transgress the commandment of God?
That's right. So he turned right around, and they said, well, why don't you keep the traditions of the elders? And he said, well, why do you also transgress the commandments of God because of your tradition? Then in the 15th chapter of Matthew, and I'll read that one in verses 7 through 9, this is what Jesus said. He said, you hypocrites, and he was talking to these same people that have these traditions. He said, hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying, these people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. So that kind of pulls in. So going back to our story now, we kind of got detracted from that. But those pots were sitting there because they were for water, and it was water to be used in the rite of purification. And I'm going to make some comments on exactly what that was in just a second, but remember when Jesus dined with a Pharisee and he didn't wash his hands? Now, this is in Luke, and I'll read it also. Luke, the beginning in verse 37. And as he spoke, a certain Pharisee asked him to dine with him. So he went in and sat down to eat. And when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled that he did not first wash before dinner. Then the Lord said to him, now you Pharisees make the outside of the cup and dish clean, but your inward parts is full of greed and wickedness. What's that? What would we call that? The outside's clean, the inside's dirty.
Hypocrisy.
That's exactly right. That is wrong. Hypocrisy is wrong. And he really blasted the Pharisees and anyone that was hypocrites. Jesus really blasted them or taught against such a thing. And then he made another statement. He said, foolish ones, did not he who made the outside make the inside also? In other words, he said, but rather give alms of such things as you have, and then indeed all things are clean to you. So in other words, clean up your hypocrisy if you have it. Now, you know, according to the Jewish tradition, they washed their hands and the pots and pans before and after eating to cleanse themselves ceremonially according to their tradition. Very strict, very excessive amount of washing the hands. So we can see why they needed a lot of water to do that. And one reason that they were very careful to wash before meals was because just in case they had touched a Gentile. Or maybe they'd rubbed against a publican or a harlot in the marketplace. Now, note, this was not teaching from the Old Testament. That's a tradition. And neither is it in the New Testament. Now, is it good to wash our hands before we eat? Certainly it is.
Do you think maybe that part of that tradition came from the law of Moses, where if they touched an unclean animal or they touched something that they were forbidden to touch, they would have to be quarantined for a period of days,
mm-hmm.
even cut off from the rest of the people?
That's right. I'm sure it probably did.
Maybe
yeah.
It came from
that. Yeah. Yeah, they did. Okay.
They seem to take it a step further, though, and then they would, you know, I was looking in Mark, the 7th chapter, and he says, for the Pharisees, this is verse 3, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the traditions of the elders. And so they always put these stipulations on that God never put on there.
Right.
You got to hold your hands a certain way. It's got to be done like this. They would subdivide and divide and divide and subdivide the division of all these different things they come up with.
What they claim they were doing by doing this?
Being holy.
Well, being holy, but by writing down these other things, they were what? They claimed they were helping people to understand what God wanted them to do. Because they were teaching that as, well, now here's really what God means by this. But they went way beyond what they should have. I mean, some of the things they said wasn't necessarily wrong in and of themselves to do. But okay, let's move on to verse 7. And then Jesus said to them, so here we have those six pots over there. And Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water, and they filled them up to the brim. So when he said, fill the water pots with water, here Jesus is requesting. He's, what do you suppose the servants and those nearby were thinking when he did this, when he said this? I don't know, because we're really not told how they felt. And probably it maybe is kind of pointless to even wonder about the extent of the miracle, but people do today. There are people who bring this up, and they want to know, well, when did the water become wine? Was it only when it was drawn out of that water pot and put in a cup? Is that when it became wine? Or did all the water in each of the pots just become wine and remain that way? Well, however it happened, we still believe it was a miracle that it occurred, and it occurred for the manifestation of the glory of God. Or, when we say the glory of God, we're talking about the recognition of the deity of Christ. And this recognition of those who observed the miracle, really, what was involved in their recognition of that glory is, in other words, it was causing them to have a favorable thought. These people having a favorable thought based on the absolute truth of God, and then that became their basis of faith. So, this manifestation of the glory of God is something that when we can recognize that, and it causes us to have a right or favorable thought based on what God has said or did, then that's the basis of our faith. And you know what? That's the basis of our faith today, too. What is it that a believer confesses at baptism? What does he make? What confession do we make at baptism?
That we're sinners.
Hmm?
Jesus is the Christ,
the Son of God. So we're stating that we recognize the deity of Christ. And that's what it's about. Why do you suppose Jesus employed the servants to fill the water pots?
That was their job.
It was their job. And they were right there. And it appears that there was a kind of a small group right around Jesus at that time. But I think the disciples of his servants, and they filled the water pots. And in other words, I think he had them do it instead of himself doing it or even his disciples doing it. Because if he would have had someone else do it, then the crowd might say, well, you're deceiving us. You're trying to make it look like a miracle, but you're actually putting some wine, you're mixing wine in with that. So what was the significance of he told them to fill it? They filled it to the top. Why'd they do that?
They didn't have room to mix.
Okay, so they didn't have room to mix any in. So they can't delude the guest on that. And then in verse 8, and he said to them, draw out some now. And take to the master of the feast. And they took it. And he said to them, now this them, who is them?
I guess these are still the servants.
Yeah, I think
the disciples who are with Jesus.
Yeah. I think that's right. It's probably referring back in verse 7 to them, which, and that refers back to the servants that Mary addressed in verse 5. So I think we're still talking about those servants. And he said, draw out some now. How quickly do you think the servants drew out from the water pots? Probably right away. I think probably that they immediately drew it out the way it reads. And they, from the same pots that were filled with water just moments before. See, not leaving any time in there for anything to be added to it or to be messed with. So they immediately dipped down and took out a cup of the water, what was water. And what did they draw out? Wine. Yeah. And how do we know that? What did the master say?
It was better than the first.
The master confirms that it was wine. And he should know. And the quality of the wine was good. And we're going to be talking more about next week. We'll be getting into talking about the wine. What was the wine and what was it? We'll be discussing that next week. But yeah, go ahead.
I think it's interesting that here's these servants who just put water in it. And then Jesus says, take it to the master. And they didn't even question him. Well, who in the right mind would do that if you're a servant? Because you're going to be in big trouble if you take water. But yet, at least we don't have any record of them questioning Jesus. I mean, nobody would believe that you put water in and the next second you take wine out.
No.
But they did it.
They did it. And they probably didn't know that it was wine yet.
Probably not.
And so, you know, I mean, this story just fits right together because who better to take it to than the head master of this whole banquet that's going on? And let him taste of it. So, who is the master of the feast? What? Well, I just used the word head waiter, and the reason I did is because Endicott, an old commentator, said, it seems reasonable to think that the person intended is what we would call the head waiter, whose duty it was to taste the viands, that's an old word, but means food, and wines, to arrange the tables and couches, and to be generally responsible for the feast. So this was kind of the person who was directing this whole banquet, this whole feast. So they took it. They didn't doubt. It seems like for some reason they're beginning to, whether it was just from what Mary had instructed them to do, or they were beginning to get a feel that something's going on here. So they took it just as Jesus directed. Now remember, he had directed them to do three things then. First, fill the pot with water. Number two, draw out wine, or to draw out from the water pots. And number three, take it to the head waiter. And as Mike said, they didn't doubt at all. They did it. But Jesus himself didn't touch anything. And as we've already said, the purpose for handling it in this manner was to prevent any appearance of collusion or deceit. Okay, in verse 9, when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. So he tasted the water that was made wine. So I think the Greek wording probably in there implies that all the water in the pots had become wine at once. And we don't know at what point, but they did. It was a miracle. And not that the water became wine just when it was taken from the pots necessarily, or when the head waiter tasted it. Some say, well, it was when he tasted it. But the water had miraculously become wine, so it doesn't matter how it occurred. But skeptics, they try to make a big issue out of this about the method of the miracle. But the whole idea of the miracle is really to show how heaven will short-circuit nature sometimes, and that's a miracle, short-circuiting nature, in a way that's beyond man's comprehension. But skeptics who try to put this down, it's hard to understand, yes, but how do we understand it? By what? By faith. We understand. That's the only way we could understand it. We just accept it. It happened. I believe it. I firmly believe that that's exactly what happened. And then it said that he did not know it. Where did not know it came, where it came from. So he was talking about the wine that he was tasting. He didn't know where that wine that he was tasting came from. So it appears at this point that maybe only the ones who knew what had taken place would have been those lowly servants and Jesus' disciples and his mother. Now, there could have been a few others standing around, but we're pretty sure though that small group. So the other waiters and the guest probably didn't know. I feel pretty strong that they didn't know that the original supply of wine had run out, nor that a new batch had been miraculously made from water. So here's a question for us to ponder and to think about in this regard. Was this first public miracle of Jesus, can we compare it as being similar to his first appearance on earth, when only a few shepherds were aware of what happened?
I think it probably so. I mean, you think the Son of God and all the miracles that he did, why this one is the first? This kind of seems like a warm-up type of a miracle. It's a pretty small one in comparison, I guess, if you're thinking about raising people from the dead or healing sick people. And this seems like, why this one first? And I guess I would liken it to something to that, too, is that I think probably the purpose here is kind of twofold. One, to manifest his glory, but the other was he needed to build the confidence in his own disciples who were with him. So it was more of a private type of an environment where he could give them a little nugget of truth and say, this is just the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I guess, or suppose his birth was similar to that, is that a few people saw the power and the majesty there, and it would just grow
from there. Yeah, yeah, I agree with what Eric said. I think that's exactly probably what's taking place. Because, you know, if you just notice the text of this story, now I know it's not a very long story, and it doesn't have all the details in there of everything that happened or didn't happen, but, you know, we don't notice any oohs and ahs from the people standing around when the wine was poured and tasted. And even when the head waiter tasted of it, he made this statement, but we don't know that how many right around him knew what was actually going on. So, you know, and it doesn't tell us about any looks of recognition of people turning and looking toward this 30-year-old carpenter named Jesus who was from Nazareth. You know, the story doesn't tell us anything about that. And like Eric said, there just wasn't this sudden rush of people to Jesus' side asking him, are you the promised Messiah? But it was important that he established this fact that he was the Messiah, and that to his disciples, as Eric said, this was the big thing. He had to get them prepared first before then they could start trying to take it out to the masses of the people. And just like he had to be when he was born, the shepherds knew about it. They rejoiced and praised God that Jesus had been sent down. But as far as other people recognizing and saying, you know, oh, did you hear? The Messiah was born down in Bethlehem. You know, that word didn't get around for 30 years. Some people knew about it. Some people believed it probably, but it was very, well, two were waiting in the temple, weren't they? Anna and Simeon. And of course, that was kind of through the help of God, through the Spirit, that they were waiting there for the fulfillment of what God had promised that He was going to send to the people Israel to be able to do. But no, I believe too that the scriptural text really supports the idea that at this particular time in Cana, I think Jesus had only chosen to reveal Himself to a few humble, obedient servants, which included His disciples, and of course His mother, and those who believed in Him. Because when we get to if we read the 11th verse, which is the last one in the ones the read this morning, that's what this was all about. This was the first miracle, and the reason was to make believers. And it wasn't to make mass believers necessarily, but it was to make believers of those, the core group of His followers.
Yeah, it's interesting that at this time, wine was always kept in skins. And a stone water pot, wine would never be put in that because it's
okay.
Rivet.
Mm-hmm.
And it all happened that way.
Yeah.
So He used something that was completely opposite of
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't even thought of that. And but the water pots, they wouldn't typically have wine in a stone water pot. Yeah,
stone
mm-hmm.
pot.
It always was in skins. And now that's a good point to bring out. Thank you. But you know, I think probably remember we were talking about when Jesus' mother, she first asked Him, "Hey, we've run out of wine. What are you going to do? Are you going to help? What are you going to do to help us? You know, and what was his statement that he made?
Not my time.
Huh? My hour has not yet come. Yeah, it's not quite that time. And so I think that's kind of what this is saying. It wasn't in the divine timetable for Him to be openly manifested at this time as the Messiah. Now, as He goes on into His ministry, and as we read from Matthew, Mark, and Luke, also the stories about them, there were times that He actually told them, didn't He caution them about even saying anything about Him being the Messiah? And isn't that true? And He said, no, don't tell them that yet.
Well, one of them, I don't remember if it was the blind man or the lepers, He healed them and said, "Go your way and don't tell anybody."
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, that
they
always.
Did,
yeah, they did.
Contest.
Yeah. And that always kind of bothered me. I'm like, well, why doesn't He want His manifestation of His glory to be made known? You know. But He would tell them, no, don't go tell them. But like Mike said, they always did. And then I thought, well, maybe, you know, sometimes when you tell someone not to do something, that's exactly what they do. But I don't know that He was playing that reverse psychology trick.
Well, he knew they would do it anyway.
Yeah, he knew they
Why
would
didn't
be.
He tell them?
Yeah.
There must be a reason He told them not to tell them.
Yeah,
and I wonder if some of that had to do with kind of his integrity. He didn't want people to think that he was doing his miracles for attention.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
But I don't know. I mean, He obviously knew they were going to do it anyway, so why did He waste His time telling them that?
Yeah. Yeah, I've always kind of struggled. Anybody else have any thoughts? What have you thought about that?
Well, remember at one point, I can't remember if it was when He fed the 5,000 or what, they were going to come and make Him king by force.
Yeah.
And so He disappeared. Kind of got out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe He was afraid that, well, he knew what was going to happen, but He didn't want this to happen too early, so He would have to leave the people.
Right, yeah. So I think we can see that this timetable, this divine timetable, it was at work through all this, and of course God was in control, and it was going to happen when He wanted it to happen, and that's the way it did. And we may not always understand exactly why certain things happen, but we certainly can understand the results and know that it was right, even though I can't figure it out. And, you know, that's the way it is in life about a lot of things that happen to us in our lives. We wonder why. Why did this happen to me at this time? We don't know. And it may be our own doings. Probably does have something with to do with our own doings, the things that we've done. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's something that happens to our loved one or someone else. And we wonder about it. But if we'll keep in mind that God's will, things will happen according to God's will. And God's will is never wrong. God's will is always right. And even though I may not like what happened, usually someday down in life, maybe never, but usually someday down in life, then something will happen and you'll say, well, now I kind of understand why that happened to me. Any other comments or thoughts? Our time is just about up here. Well, we'll pick up then where we left off and next Sunday, and we'll finish up. Like I say, so if you want to study about why was the wine was it toxic? It'll be toxic. But was it what's the word I'm trying to say?
New wine or old wine?
New wine or old wine, but intoxicating. That's why I'm trying. Was the wine intoxicating? Was it? Did it have the alcohol content to be intoxicating, or was it just plain grape juice? So you know, there's different opinions on that. We'll kind of think about those, and we'll look at some of those and next week and in our study. But thank you for your comments. Appreciate it very much.